And a good Sunday morning to you. I'm Jerry Kenny. This is WISO Weekend, the home of WISO-produced news and features. On today's program, remember the Robert Mapplethorpe exhibit in Cincinnati way back and the big controversies that stirred up? Today, WISO Community Voices producer Susan Burns takes us back for a little reminder. We'll also tell you what's happening at this year's Film Dayton Festival coming up next weekend when we talk to Executive Director Lisa Grigsby. Up first, end-of-life decisions can be tough to make, and many people never even get to make those decisions. Dayton native Amy Pickard now lives in L.A. and has started a business that, in a unique way, is helping people make those decisions. Her company is called Good to Go, and I met her in an appropriate setting to talk about it on a recent visit back to Dayton. Here's part of the conversation we had at Woodland Cemetery.
Good to Go is my advanced planning company, and I guide people through their end-of-life paperwork, which consists of an advanced health care directive and an advanced death care directive. And I do personal consulting, or what I'm known for now is having Good to Go parties, and I describe them as almost a death Tupperware party, where everyone comes together and we go through the paperwork in a party setting.
Tell me a little bit about how that works and the response you get from participants.
Well, I just initially formed this company in order to share the information that I learned once my mom passed away. And I just wanted to share the information. But what I discovered was when we go over it in sort of a party-like atmosphere, it's actually fun and people have a great time. And sometimes we have alcohol, sometimes we don't, but everyone brings a potluck dish to share and drinks. And we go through it with a fun death-related soundtrack. And it's just a lot easier. It makes it a lot less intimidating for people, because obviously when you're talking about something so serious, I think it's really good to have more sort of levity involved, and it takes away the kind of stigma of sadness and morbidity and things like that, and it makes it a little more, you face your fears, basically, and that's a liberating thing.
Certainly, people are varying degrees of emotional state when the time actually comes, so I imagine getting this all out in the open and done with provides a lot of relief for people.
It provides an amount of peace that people don't understand they're going to need. And that's the tough thing that I've come across in trying to convince people to do this. But, you know, when you can do it in a party-like atmosphere, when you're of sound mind and sound body and you're perfectly healthy now, it just prevents a lot of complications down the line and a lot of awkwardness when the subject is broached. You can say, I've already, you know, talked about this and I'm good to go. I've got the paperwork, and it just makes it easier for the doctors. It makes it easier for the relatives, and it makes it easier for you to be able to say, I've already discussed this with my family and loved ones.
You describe a party atmosphere, but do you find that families really open up to each other at these parties?
Definitely. And that's the beauty of it, too, is that it is a community and people do feel like it's a safe place that they can share their feelings and emotions. But not that it's some, you know, touchy-feely kumbaya thing, but everyone is there. We know that we're going to be talking about serious things. And obviously, you know, it pushes buttons. And death is a very sacred thing to a lot of people. It just depends on what attitude you have, you know, but then you feel it out on the day. Some older people that I talk to who I've done Good to Go parties with, you know, they want maybe a slightly more reverential tone. And so we, you know, bring it down a notch and take a more serious approach. But then, you know, obviously the kids in their 20s who I've gotten Good to Go, it's such an abstract thing down the line that they are able to laugh and joke about it. And so it's a lot more convivial. But it definitely pushes buttons, but it pushes my buttons too, because, you know, I've experienced loss and sometimes I get choked up talking about things. But then I always say, you know, if you can't cry over your dead mom, what can you cry over? You know, you just have to let your freak flag fly.
You're obviously talking to people who want to be prepared, but there are a lot of people who probably don't give this a thought until the time comes, and that's unfortunate.
Well, this is the problem. I mean, I think less than 20% of adults have anything in writing or have even discussed this with not only with their doctors or estate planners or estate lawyers, but with their loved ones. And it's and I've found when I tell people what I do, they either back away slowly or they say, you know what, I've been meaning to do that. This sounds like a good idea. You know, give me a call. I would love to do this. So it is. I'm just encouraging people. Of course, I would love to get you good to go, but if you go somewhere else and get your advanced planning done, please do it. You know, it's that important. People just need to start the conversation, and hopefully with good to go, I make it a little easier to do that.
I want to know a little bit about you. Tell me a little bit about your history here in Dayton.
Well, I was born and raised in Dayton, and I am a mass comm major from Wright State, and I went into television, and I've made my living as a freelance television producer. And I worked for the BBC in London, and then I also did red carpet interviews. And so my friends joked that I'm going from VIP to RIP. and I still do a little bit of freelance stuff here and there for Getty Images, for red carpets and press junkets and things. But Good to Go is my focus now. But my life completely transformed once my mom passed away unexpectedly 3 years ago. And it was almost like someone just changed the cosmic channel. And I knew I wanted to help people in some capacity around the topic of death and dying, because it was such a transformative thing for me. And it was actually a positive experience as well as being, you know, horribly traumatic and sad. And that's something that I was surprised that not a lot of people talk about. And then I discovered there is a death positive movement, which is made up of several groups who are trying to change the cultural narrative of how we view death. And try to, you know, express to people that it is a transition, it is a natural transition, and to not be so scared of it and afraid of it. And so, you know, my little part of the death positive movement is in advanced planning, but you can have, you know, death midwifery or death doulas or green burials or the home funeral movement. You know, all of these different movements are under that umbrella of the death positive movement.
Amy Pickard talking about her company, Good to Go, which helps people make end-of-life decisions in a way that celebrates the life they have now. In the late 1980s, photographer Robert Mapplethorpe's exhibition, The Perfect Moment, fueled the fire of the so-called culture wars. The time period pitted right-wing politicians like Senator Jesse Helms against artists and museums in a battle over federal arts funding and First Amendment rights. When Mapplethorpe's exhibit opened at the Contemporary Arts Center in Cincinnati, the museum and its director were brought up on obscenity charges. 25 years later, the museum is considering the impact of those events on the arts in America through a major exhibit and symposium. For Culture Couch, Susan Burns of WYSO has this preview.
The city of Cincinnati, Ohio, made national headlines on April 7th, 1990, with reports of police, protests, and pornography.
What you're watching now is the Cincinnati police as they made their move today against the Contemporary Arts Center, spurring a legal showdown over the controversial Robert Mapplethorpe exhibit.
And it was a showdown, a contentious trial over the sexual content of 7 photographs in the exhibit. The current curator of the Contemporary Arts Center, Stephen Maticio, has heard plenty of stories about that era since he arrived in Cincinnati 2 years ago, when his first order of business was to plan for the 25th anniversary of Mapplethorpe.
And when we say Mapplethorpe, we mean as much the art and the exhibition and the artist as we do the controversy, the trial, the indictment, the acquittal. All of those things become wrapped up into that singular word.
Nationally, that word also came to mean censorship. Along with celebrity portraits and still lifes, Robert Mapplethorpe was famous for making classically composed images of men engaged in practices of sadomasochism. Mapplethorpe's artwork boldly confronted moral values, and there was tremendous political pressure on museums to remove these photographs from his exhibit. Curator Stephen Maticio.
I think we typically associate that with totalitarian sort of systems of government, where a presiding order decides what the larger public can see. And in a lot of ways, it shapes a particular ideology. And I think that freedom comes with the ability to decide whether this offends me or not, or whether I want to argue about this. But I think that we all need to have that freedom to be exposed to information, whether that's text-based information or visual information or any kind of cultural information. A free society needs to be able to make that decision for themselves.
Because Mapplethorpe's images continue to challenge viewers as well as artists, Metizio commissioned 41 new works for an exhibition called After the Moment. One invited artist is Joel Whitaker, a photographer and professor of art at the University of Dayton. His idea started with a library book he found on Mapplethorpe's work.
Someone had gone through the book and actually razored out some of the photographs. One in particular was of two men in San Francisco who were in bondage and S&M. And so I opened the book up almost like it was a human form. So there's a bit of sexuality to the book. And I photographed the slice. I photographed the cut. And I was kind of like puzzled by the whole thing because I didn't know, did he or she take the photograph out because they found it offensive? Did they find it too hard to, too difficult to deal with? Or did they just simply want it for their wall?
Who gets to decide which images get cut and why? That question was the legacy left by Mapplethorpe, who died in 1989. As for the trial back in 1990, a Cincinnati jury made up of mostly working-class people, including a secretary, a warehouse manager, a saleswoman, and an electrical engineer, decided that Mapplethorpe's work was not obscene. They upheld the First Amendment protections that grant the Contemporary Art Center's right to display his images, the right of the artist to make and show them, and the right of people like you and me to see them. This is Susan Burns for WYSO.
A symposium about Mapplethorpe's work begins on Friday, October 23rd, and the exhibit After the Moment opens November 6th at the Contemporary Arts Center in Cincinnati. For more information, visit us at WYSO.org. I'm Jerry Kenny. This is WYSO Weekend. The Film Dayton Festival rolls around once again this year, and to find out what films and other events organizers have put together this year, I spoke with Film Dayton's new executive director, Lisa Grigsby.
Lisa, you're fairly new to this position, correct?
I am. I took it over officially at July 1st, and so I knew this daunting task in front of me was the Film Dayton Festival right away, and so jumped right in. But I guess I had some familiarity since I've been one of the founding members and been on the board since it started in 2007.
Let's talk about this year's festival. It's coming up Friday, October 23rd, it begins.
Yes, that's correct. We kick it off Friday the 23rd with Pitch It, which is one of my favorite events of the whole festival. If you've ever had an idea that you think would be the next killer movie or some kind of amazing TV series or webinar, you can come to our Pitch It. You get 2 minutes to share your idea in front of a panel of industry experts and a lot of fans as well. The judges will give you some feedback on it, and they are going to pick one as the winning pitch, which will win $1,000, which will help you start to produce whatever that show or movie is.
So 2 minutes, it's slightly longer than the elevator pitch that they teach you in business school. How do people handle that 2 minutes of pressure?
It's kind of interesting. And you've got some people that really know exactly what they're going, and you can tell that they've got it scripted out, down to the second. And then you've got other people that get up there and, they have such a big idea that they can't seem to contain it. And unfortunately, we've seen, the buzzer go off and they get cut off mid-idea. So we really suggest that you practice it. You've got, that 2 minutes ready to go. You've practiced it out loud in front of the mirror, all those tips that they give you, so that your pitch is right there. And the one thing that having those industry experts will do is, even if you're not the winning pitch, they're going to give you some ideas and go, oh, well, I don't see it clearly enough, or here's where you should go, or this is what you should do, or, that's so last year, or that's been done so many times. So just sometimes that feedback, too, is very valuable.
How many people tend to participate in this event?
We've got time allotted for 12 people. I know right now I've got 3 great pitches that have already signed up. You can sign up online at filmdayton.com if you want to pitch for it. And we ask that you give us your information, give us your log line, which is just your basic, there's your elevator speech, just to give us an idea, because we don't want to have like 10 zombie movies pitch in a row. So you'll do that, and we'll put them in there. And that's Friday, October 23rd, starting at 5 o'clock.
So what else do we have in the lineup for the weekend?
Right after that, we have our opening film on a Friday night, Carisha, which was an audience award winner and a jury award winner at South by Southwest. And I point out the two differences because it is kind of a psycho thriller, but the fact that the critics liked it and the audience likes it, two totally different audiences. So it's got major, major mass appeal. After that, we will have Flick My Clip, which this is the fourth year we've had comic Ryan Singer, who is a Dayton native, curate comedy shorts that will come out for us. That will happen. And then at 11:45 on Friday night, we have The Seven Hells. You know, it is right around Halloween time. So we have this one showing, and it is seven of the best horror award-winning movies from all kinds of horror festivals around the country. So there's your Friday night horror fun. And then we roll into Saturday morning. And Saturday morning, we kick off with our high school shorts block. You know, one of the things that's so cool about film right now is film is being made at all levels. It's not, you know, quite as expensive to get into. People have actually made movies with their iPhones. And we've got a lot of high school programs. So we've got a whole block of shorts from high school groups that will be coming in.
And those are local high schools?
They're from actually all over the country. We did do submissions this year. So we've actually got some from Ohio. We've got from all over the country. And I think we also have Australia, Japan, and Canada represented. So we truly are an international film festival this year.
Nice. Let me just ask you quickly, since you just came on board in July, did you have to jump right in curating the films for this, or was that process already underway?
Well, we're very lucky. One of our other board members, Dave Temesfeld, is actually the festival director. And so he had started the submission process and probably started it back in May or June. We've had more submissions than we ever have this year. And then he has a panel of judges that actually go through and watch the films and rate them. So it's not just any one person that's putting them together. We've had, you know, five or six people watch a film and go, yep, we think that one's worthy. So we actually have more shorts this year. We have four different blocks of shorts that are all been submitted this year over the week. Weekend.
Great. What's on for midday on Saturday?
Well, we've got a couple workshops that are going on this year. Kind of the whole idea behind that is the business of film is the theme of our workshops this year. So our very first one on Saturday at 12:30 will be all about the unions. And that's been a huge learning experience for me. I had no idea how many unions were involved with making films. So whether it's, you know, SAG-AFTRA for the actors, whether it's the Teamsters, you know, the IATSE 209. So we've got a panel discussion that will be like how to work with the unions. So it'll tell you, you know, depending on the level of your film, who you need to reach out to. So we'll have a panel of people representing the union saying how to make it work.
Great.
And then in the afternoon, we'll have another panel that's Call Your Lawyer. So we'll have a panel of lawyers because that's one of the things, too, that making a film is so much more of a business than I ever realized. You know, you've got to start your company. You've got to figure out what kind of offerings you're going to have, how to trademark and copyright all the information that you're going to go through. So that panel will help future filmmakers know exactly where to go.
Following the panel, you've got another block of shorts.
Yes. More shorts that are going on in the afternoon. We've got an Ohio shorts block. We also have an amazing feature at 3 in the afternoon on Saturday, Akron, and which was obviously made in Akron by Akron filmmakers, an LGBT-friendly selection that has been an award-winning one. And we will have all the producers and directors from that here for a Q&A after the movie, which is very cool. Then at 7:30 on Saturday night, Breaking a Monster, which this is really interesting. It follows a group of three young teenagers who start a metal band and have huge success. And it kind of is a documentary that follows their success and how things change from their love of the business to, you know, the parents and the agents and the money grubbing and what goes on. So a really cool thing. Rolling Stone calls that one a must see.
What kind of balance do you try to strike as far as documentaries versus feature or fiction films?
We really are very careful about that because we get a ton of documentaries and a lot of the Wright State film students do a lot of documentaries. So while we think they're amazing, we also want to make sure there's some narratives in there and some great stories that you can get caught up in. Sunny in the Dark, which is our late show on Saturday night, is kind of one of those. It's about a marriage counselor who works and he's kind of a recluse in his real life and he lives all alone in a big loft. And then he finds out that he's not really all alone, that there's somebody living in his attic space. So that'll be a very interesting one, and that kind of wraps up Saturday. And then we move on to Sunday.
All right. What's in the lineup for the final day of the festival?
Well, one of the coolest workshops I think that we're going to do on Sunday, if you have ever wanted to make a film or thought about it, we're bringing in an industry expert from New York City to teach a whole seminar on funding your film, whether it be making the budget, whether it's crowdsource funding, finding out how to get grants, how to raise money from your friends, family, and max out your credit cards is usually what most filmmakers do. So we're hoping that in putting this together, people will learn about all the different ways they can do it. Then we've got some more shorts. We've got a really cool film, A Gospel According to Charlie, which is our Ohio selection. It's 8 years in the making, and it's kind of a – it is a documentary following 8 years of the life of this gentleman who does some incredibly creative work and what brings him along. And I don't want to say too much, but it's definitely – it's adult in nature, but it's a very fun, interesting show. And then Sunday afternoon at 5:30 is the one I am most looking forward to. It's called Becoming Bulletproof. It is a film about making a film. There's a L.A. group of filmmakers that every year for the last 8 years, they have brought a group of disabled kids along to make a movie. And – well, it's cool, and they go through the whole process of it. One of the coolest things about it is one of the young actors talks about, I just want to make a movie that has people like me in it. You never see disabled people in movies, and it's incredibly charming, and the reviews have been amazing. So looking forward to that. And then we wrap up the festival with the hometown premiere of the Ross Brothers, which are two guys out of Sydney, Ohio, that have made some amazing films. This is the third year we've been able to showcase one of their films. Huge Sundance Award-winning, amazing visuals, and that's called Western.
And you're going to wrap up the weekend with a wrap party.
Absolutely. You know, we'll have all these filmmakers and all kinds of people and all of the volunteers, and we're going to have a little fun party afterwards where everyone gets to mix and mingle, and it's going to be at the Tasty Measures Cafe, which is yet to open to the public. So it'll be our little preview of that, and that's right next to the Neon Theater, and the Neon is where all of our movies are screened and all of our workshops are at Think TV.
Great. And people can get more details and information on ticket sales at filmdayton.com.
Absolutely. Filmdayton.com. You can also find us with a lot of the trailers on our Facebook page if you want to check those out. And then you can also pick up tickets right there at the Neon on the day of.
Nice. Lisa Grigsby, Executive Director with Film Dayton. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks. See you at the movies.
This is WISO Weekend on WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. The fall season is usually thought of as a good time to plant trees, and yesterday Dayton Power and Light gave them away to visitors at some local nurseries. The giveaway was part of DP&L's Right Tree, Right Place program. We spoke to Holly Wiggins, Director of Community and Corporate Social Responsibility, to remind us what this program's all about.
Great. Holly, today we're going to talk about a program with DP&L called Right Tree, Right Place. Tell us about this program.
Well, the Right Tree, Right Place program was developed so that we could educate our customers on how to plant trees in a smart way, to think about the utilities and the equipment that's out there that might be hindered by those trees as they grow and mature.
This is actually something that people don't normally think when they're doing landscaping projects, I would think.
No, it is not the normal thing they think about first. They look at their yard and what they like and what they want, which is understandable. We do have nurseries and greenhouses in the area that will tell people, or if you've got a landscaper in, that think about those things. But most of us don't typically think about that. We're just looking at what we want aesthetically in our yard. And what we're asking is people to think about the fact that there's overhead lines, you've got electric boxes, you do have underground utilities as well. And these plants that are utility-friendly keep the branches from being up in the wires and keep roots from being in the wrong spots. We're asking you not to plant too close to these utility boxes. When we need access to those, we don't have time to cut back bushes and plants, and they also don't have time to worry about whether they've stepped on something that is precious to you. So we don't want people to put those things in the way because we don't want to cause trouble for them in their yards and disrupt what they have and enjoy.
And I think this is something that people actually should be mindful of if they go to the trouble of planting a beautiful tree that eventually grows up and then has to be cut in some odd fashion for safety reasons, as you're mentioning. So tell us how DP&L is working with local residents on this.
So what we've done is we've created a brochure that is available at some local nurseries and some of your parks, but we've also got it online at www.dpandl.com/righttree. And you can download that brochure. It's got information about what types of trees and how tall they grow. And that's when you go in and buy a plant, you want to ask these things. Hey, I've got a tree. It's going to be – and we've even got drawings. So you don't want it too close to your house. If there's a storm that comes through, you don't want it on your house. You don't want the branches when there's a windstorm going on or ice storm, them resting on the wires, because then you have potential to cause outages at your home, outages at your neighbor's home. If it's cold, if it's hot, you're very uncomfortable then when those outages occur. And we don't want to go in and have to cut branches in an odd way out of a tree, but we have to for safety and reliability of the system. We are required to do those things. We've got arborists that work for us that don't take pleasure in knowing that that's what's had to be done. So it's beneficial for us, and it's beneficial for our customers.
Let's talk about other programs that are in the future or underway.
Underway for this fall with our Right Tree, Right Place, we've got a new partnership with a organization called Operation 1000 Cherry Tree Project, which is something that was started as a thank you to the citizens for the help that was given to Japan after effects of the 2011 earthquake and tsunami. And they are trying to get 1,000 cherry trees out and planted in the Ohio area, and so that we've got an impact like they do in D.C. in the spring. And so with that partnership in mind, we're giving away 100 cherry trees, and we're trying to do those in groups. So we are offering subdivisions, homeowners associations, historic housing districts, your block, if you've got 20 people on your block that you want to try and get together, small business groups up and down, you know, a couple blocks, they can get one tree each and plant those in the front yards or front lawns of these businesses, maybe in the common grounds or the entrance to these subdivisions. And this spring, it'll just be a beautiful impact. And any group can get up to 100 trees.
This is all great, and I think you're going to find that a lot of people are interested in this, and it's just a small part of the community outreach that happens within DP&L.
Correct. We try and do things with the communities in mind. We give grants every year to nonprofits, and with that in mind, we've got two community grants going out with this. So our Tree City USA cities and communities that are in our service territory will be able to apply beginning today for one of two $50,000 environmental grants where they can improve some public space or park in those communities, a portion of that being used to plant utility-friendly trees or do their environmental improvements, and then beautify that public space for everyone to enjoy. So that's just another way for us to reach out to our communities.
Where can folks go? We've given them a lot of information. Where can they find out more about the participating nurseries and other partners with DP&L?
Yeah, we have a website. Go to dpandl.com/righttree. That will give you the information about everything we've got going on in the Right Tree, Right Place program. It will also give you information about what nurseries to go to. We would love our customers to share their new trees and how their yards are looking and how beautiful they become this spring especially, but even through the fall as their yards, as they're putting new plantings in. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at DPL Today, hashtag Right Tree, Right Place.
Holly Wiggins is Director of Community and Corporate Social Responsibility with Dayton Power and Light. Thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Jerry.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the third week of middle fall and the second week of the deer mating moon. It's the transition week of the sun to Scorpio. The vigil for spring begins with middle fall, and the Big Dipper at midnight is one of the easier markers for judging the progress of the year. When its pointers, named Merrick and Dubay, point north-south and the dipper lies tight against the northern horizon, then most of the country has entered autumn. Leaves are turning and birds migrating and flower time is closing. When Merrick and Dubay, over in the eastern half of the sky, point east-west as well as to Polaris, the North Star, the harvest is complete and all the leaves are down and winter solstice is approaching. when Merrick and Dubé, deep in the center of the sky, point exactly north-south in the middle of the night. Then pasture season is moving north from the Gulf of Mexico, and early spring brings new crocus and snowdrops into bloom, and robins and cardinals sing before dawn. When the pointers point west-east at midnight, with the Dipper itself in the west, then all the lilies come into bloom, and middle summer crickets and katydids sing the season. Not static or impassive like the linear squares and numbers on the calendar, the stars keep vigil with us, always turning and always promising. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the final week of middle fall. In the meantime, look for the Big Dipper in the middle of the night. Watch it and the seasons turn through the months ahead.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, public radio for the Miami Valley. I'm Jerry Kenny. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.